Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 16th, 2005. Today's session is entitled City of God, Where We Live and God's Creation, Trends, Rationality, Human and Natural. Presented by Will Schroer, session number SCW-2005-02. Let's listen in.
My day job is that I run the transportation and land use division of a large consulting firm called ICF Consulting, and the joke is that it stands for it's a consulting firm. it's not really what it stands for. When I give talks like this, the first thing is I don't usually get the opportunity to talk about cities and relationships in my professional work. It's usually somewhat less interesting than that. So you'll have to forget, I'm very excited to talk about that subject, but it's also not what I usually do, so we're gonna have to do this together. The second thing is that when I do give talks like this, you know, people are interested, where are you from, what are your academic degrees, et cetera. In other words, what do you know about the subject that we should pay attention to? And what I'd like to suggest is that really the qualifications that one needs to talk about this subject, mine happen to be, I'm attempting to be, these four things, and that really the only qualifications that one needs to be an intelligent discussant about city design and the way that we should live in cities and where should our cities be and what should they look like is we should be fully people because cities are about being fully human. And so these are the qualifications that I bring to this subject that I don't usually get to talk about in my professional career, but which I think are actually the important ones. And you have similar ones, not exactly the same, but you have very similar ones, and I encourage you to bring those to your thinking about cities and urban design and how we should make policy around cities. One of the questions that we dove into yesterday, both because I think it's very interesting and also in an attempt to link this discussion to the larger theme of standing on holy ground in theology is Christianity pro or anti-place? And more specifically, is Christianity pro or anti-city? And this is the time for me to wave the two books that I recommend in the bookstore, and I recommend them to you unreservedly. And they treat this subject in more detail than I'm going to be able to in part. The first is called Sidewalks in the Kingdom by a guy named Eric Jacobson. He was a pastor in Missoula who had no background in city planning or anything remotely related to that whatsoever. But in the course of his pastoral work, began to get interested in, you know, why different parts of Missoula were good for people and why certain parts of Missoula were bad for people, and started getting interested in city planning and city design. Wrote a book out of that experience and thinking this book, which marries for the first time that I've really seen it well done, discussions of new urbanism and smart growth and city planning with an explicitly theological approach to, you know, how we should be designing our cities, you know, today. And he opens with a lovely discussion of how the Bible has changed its thinking about cities, which we're going to talk about briefly. I guess the bottom, the one-line sort of summary of this debate is that God operates in places. He chose a place to meet Moses. The burning bush was located in a place, and one can't really imagine God working any other way except in places, because we're in places, and so that's where God will reach us. The counter-argument is God was not choosing a place, God was choosing a person, and that person moves, and God moves through that person, as God is not really that interested in particular places, God is interested in particular people. I think it's interesting debate. They talk about it in much more detail than I'm going to be able to, but I encourage you to think about this argument as we go forward through the week and as you're doing other things around the village. The other book, which I highly recommend, which is in the bookstore, is Jane Jacobs, The Death and Life of the Great American City, or Great American Cities, plural. This is now 40 years old and remains sort of absolutely fresh and relevant and is really the, and I try not to use this term too much, but the Bible of new thinking in city planning. And as it happens, it's mostly about relationships in cities, which is what our topic today is. So those are the two things in the bookstore, and I recommend them absolutely wholeheartedly to you. This is a much quicker read and than this is, so if you're looking to kind of put your toe in, I recommend the Jacobson. What we talked about yesterday is why do we build what we build? And what I did is I threw up a bunch of pictures, and people rated them. And as it turns out, the things that we liked are the things that we do not build today, and in fact have made illegal to build. And the things that we hate is what we spend a lot of time and money building today. And then we talked about why that was the case. And was there some theological reason for that? You know, Paul says, I do not do the things I want to do, but I do the things I hate. And today we build the things that we hate. Why do we do that? Or is there a sort of financial, legal, you know, political reason? So that's what we did yesterday. Today I'd like to talk about cities and relationships. Tomorrow, when I talk about these subjects, a lot of times the response is, well, yeah, stuff looks like crap, but you know, it's efficient. And so we're going to talk about the economics of that argument. I'm going to talk mostly out of a book called If You're So Smart, which treats what this guy calls the American question. If you're so smart, why aren't you rich? And which I think is a fascinating question, actually. Anyway, he talks about storytelling and economics, and so tomorrow we're going to talk about the story that the modernist planners would have. You believe that if you build crap, you'll be rich. We'll talk about how to interpret that economic story and some others as well. Thursday, we'll talk about kids in cities, because they really benefit and bear the burden of all the good and bad stuff in cities more even than adults. And then on Friday, even though I hope we talk about alternatives through the week, we're going to talk about, you know, specific alternatives that have been proposed, have been built, or that are working, etc. So I hope you'll be able to join me for more. If there are specific aspects of this that, you know, you're not going to be able to go to that session but want to talk to me about them, you know, snag me, let's talk about it. So today we're on day two, cities and relationships, and the word relationship has been sort of snagged, I think, in contemporary culture to mean, you know, two people kind of in a romantic relationship. Not only that, and fortunately the church, I think, has a broader view of what constitutes a relationship. And cities and whether they are good or bad for relationships of any kind is, as I suggested, a huge topic where I'm going to try and hit what I think are the high points, but I really want you to stop me and talk about other things as well. I love this picture. Pam didn't think it was as funny as I did when I showed it to her last night, but this is Honolulu, and to me this is sort of emblematic of a lot of where contemporary urban design and commercial relationships are taking us. Where did people used to go to kind of meet their, you know, significant others or people that they were courting? They used to go to the plaza, they go to the park, they go to the cafe, you know. None of those things exist anymore, or they're, you know, going away. What public space remains where you can go and kind of pitch a little woo, you know, so you haven't reached the point of going home or whatever, you know, but you want to spend a little time, you end up in the parking lot in the back of your pickup. And so let's talk about whether that's really a great thing. Let's start with where the city came from. And the city, as I think people have come to understand it over time, comes from a need and desire for human contact. And those contacts, in turn, I think, produces relationship over time. What kinds of contacts or relationships? Well, first of all, commercial. Farmers lived, you know, out on the land, but they needed things that they couldn't grow or build themselves, so they went someplace else to get that and trade their grain for the things that they didn't need. Those places became the first cities, right? So the first, cities were commercial, but people also liked to see other people. You know, you're kind of lonely out on the farm, so if you wanted to see other people, you went to town. Artistic, art, not that you can't create art on your own, obviously, but art, past a certain point, requires a little bit of surplus. Where does that surplus end up? It ends up in the city, it's a little bit of an outgrowth of the commercial. Where could an artist, you know, make a living? Well, they could do it in a city where there were a lot of people to sell to and find his work. Religious relationships and contacts. We come out of what a lot of people would call an itinerant religion. It was started by, you know, herds, people who were moving around, not a city religion, but where does it end up? It ends up in Jerusalem. It is a city religion in the end. And educational, again, not that these things don't take place in places other than cities, but the great universities, the great colleges have been outgrowths of not rural efforts, but city efforts to move forward the quest for knowledge and how do people get along. One of the great subjects of inquiry in the early colleges and universities, how should we organize society? Well, if you only have that question if there's a city to organize. You don't have that question if you're just farmers and herdsmen. So the city, again, comes out of this desire and need for relationships and contact, and I would argue that these are all dimensions of the whole person. The whole person has commercial, social, artistic, religious, and educational needs. And those the question is, do you need to go to a city to facilitate being the whole person or not? Or can you go from time to time and facilitate those things? I think that's an interesting question. But in any case, I would propose for the next hour, to think of the city as reflecting our needs and desires to be whole people. And the city expresses those. And if the city does it well, then we can do it well. And if the city doesn't do those things well, then I question whether we can be whole people as well. Claude Levi-Strauss, not the guy that started the jeans company, but the sociologist, argues that the city, for these reasons, is the best human invention because it allows people to be people, which I thought was a nice reading. We want to stop at this point? Any discussion? Okay. Yes?
Just one question. Your list there, what covers, you know, the raising of the next generation? That's also an important function of
society. That is a very important function. Thanks. What would you call that?
Maybe renewal.
Renewal, okay.
There would be more than just family. It's also renewing the culture.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, if the city is so great, if the city helps us be whole people, why this sort of antipathy toward the city over time? Well, it's because not only does the city allow contact, it forces contact. There are a lot of people in a small space, and so it happens. Well, you get, you know, even, let's put aside crime for a moment, but you will necessarily get congestion. You will probably necessarily get pollution. Because there's a certain anonymity associated with the city as we've come to know it, people feel free to do things that they might not do if people knew them better than they did. We call this vice. And that can mean any number of things, but you'll probably get some crime, maybe for the same reason that you know people think they can get away with it, or for larger reasons, which would take up you know vast bookshelves of discussion. And then I think the bottom line is that the city puts you in contact with a lot of people that you just would rather not be bothered with, frankly. And sometimes we just call these people strangers. And the Bible has a fair amount to say about strangers and how you should interact with them and treat them. Some of those admonitions are in come out of the rural culture and a culture of travelers, and you have to take in the traveler. But a lot of them are not. And a lot of them, I think, end up being fairly city-focused as well. So I urge you to keep in mind that the city involves a lot of strangers, and that can be both good and bad. So I think that this the city has, we feel a certain ambivalence about the city. I'll be bold enough to speak for you and say we. And I think that ambivalence is captured in Scripture as well. Does the Bible say builds the first city? Cain. We don't like Cain. Bad guy. And what the city, his desire to go build a city is a reaction to or a symbol of his broken relationships with his family, his God, and his land. Abel stays on the land doing what his people had done, right? But Cain had broken his relationship with his family, and so he couldn't stay on the land. He had to go someplace else and do something else. So he built a city. The city evolves into Sodom and Gomorrah, and you know we can argue about whether the crime there was lack of hospitality or you know what it was. But the bottom line is, the Bible, I think, decided that this was a bad place, right? God decided this was a bad place and needed to be destroyed. And it was a city. You don't read about outside the flood God saying, well, this district, you know, this rural area, bad place, we're going to do away with it. It's the city that gets done away with because that's the bad place. Nineveh, that great city, Jonah has to go preach to it and ask them to repent. He doesn't get sent to a rural district and say repent, then he gets sent to the great city. That's where all the problems are. Reading Jacobson instead of the Bible, because it's a lot shorter, I learned about a change in the attitudes of the cities then in Numbers, which I don't think I've really ever read except, you know, under duress. But anyway, Israel was directed to establish certain cities of refuge, where if you had, for example, killed somebody, you could go there to escape punishment. For a while, anyway. There was a little discussion in Jacobson, you know, did you eventually have to go back and stand trial, or could you just go there and, you know, start over? But in any case, the city is a place of refuge. In which Jacobson says, well, that's the beginning of the city as a place of grace. Kind of interesting. And then eventually, of course, we get to Jerusalem as the center of the relationship with God and the holy city. And where we end up at the end of this evolving relationship with God is, at the end of Revelation, we're not promised a return to Eden. We are promised that the city of God, a new Jerusalem, will come to us. Not a new Eden. We're not going to go back to the garden. That's over. But the new creation is going to be a city, which is a guy who's into cities, I think, is very exciting. And I can't wait to see it. Any discussion on this? Is my, like, gotten my Bible, my theology wrong? I thought it was kind of interesting. This is all, I got most of this out of Jacobson, so I should just put that in. But I think it's an interesting read. Let me also take this opportunity before we dive into the next sort of portion of the talk here to wave another book, which is not in the bookstore. The conscience of the eye, the design and social life of cities, and Sennett takes a third take on Christianity and cities and city design, it's just third, it's not sort of a middle path, it's just a completely different one. His argument is that Western Christianity has sort of torpedoed the city, frankly, through its emphasis on interior perfection. Because cities are mostly about exteriors, the street, the outside of the building, you know, the public space, the emphasis on the interior has torpedoed any interest in good city design and how cities work. It's an argument that I don't know if you can, you know, resolve that argument through an appeal to the facts of how things have actually been done, but it's a fascinating argument to think about. Are we paying more attention to our interior development or to the exterior and to the physical supportiveness of the community? And I urge you to read this too if you are piqued by, if your interest is piqued by that argument. The city then, as a community, if God has decided that a city is actually an interesting place and a place or a tool for redemption and a thing that he is going to bring in the end as a redeemed place, what are the constituents or the components of that city or that community, and how do they support relationship? So that's what we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about, I hope. There are any number of routes into this discussion. One that I would like to start with is taking the perspective of a city as a community that has places. A place has a center and an edge. What is a place? It's not, you know, an area. It's a specific, this is a place. And this room is a place. Let's meet in the fireside room. So the room itself is a place, but there are also places within the room. This is the center. This is what we're gathering around. Does that mean that the walls are unimportant? No. But it means that there's a structure to this room. There's the center place that we're going to gather around that's arguably a little bit more interesting than the walls. Again, walls not unimportant, but there's a structure that one has to understand to have a room that sort of works well. And just like that, a place in a city mixes uses to create understandable and legible places within the city. Let's talk about what that means. Once again, the action, and here the action that created the city is what I'm talking about, started at crossroads and with human contact. So, you know, some people were going this way, other people were going this way. They'd run into each other, they'd stop and talk. They'd maybe trade a little bit. Well, I have this, I need that, you know, can we trade a little bit? Eventually, people who wanted to trade or who wanted to talk to people would just start hanging out here, right, until somebody came along and then more people would hang. Eventually, you got the New England churches that were built at crossroads. Those were the first buildings normally that were built at crossroads were the churches. Maybe then the mercantile would follow. And then usually the third building in the town like this would be, you know, some sort of bar, actually. But anyway, those crossroads would facilitate the kind of contact that I'm talking about, right? And they were legible. They made sense. Well, I'm going to go into town to, you know, go to the church, go to the bar, go to the store. And they were understandable, and I use the word, when city planners sometimes use the word legible. You know, you looked at the church. Well, I'm going to go to the church. There's the church. Our crossroads today, I think, are none of those things, with the possible exception of gas stations. They remain kind of easily legible and understandable because they have a big tower. But everything else is a little bit of a mishmash and do not really facilitate contact. No one is running into anybody else here except by accident. And accident has been, you know, is the appropriate term. It's become a bad thing, not a good thing, to run into somebody by accident. But we can save our crossroads. We've done it. This crossroads puts just as many cars through, if that's what you think is the important measure, but it also puts people in contact with each other as they go from one place to another. Now, you know, are all these people going to, you know, stop and talk to each other and say, oh, you know, I didn't know I was going to run into you here today, but, you know, here you are, let's talk. No, most of them are not, but some of them will. And one of the nice, I just have to keep waving Jacobson because I think it's such a cool book. He is a pastor in Missoula, and he talks about walking, you know, downtown to do shopping, running into parishioners, and he explains how it became clear to him that he could not do his pastoral job as well in a suburb because he would not be running into people that he needed to run into. Either because, you know, he needed to see somebody and he wasn't going to see him, or they needed to see him but didn't know it. And, you know, they're not going to drive out to X place and say, you know, I got to talk to a pastor, but he runs into them downtown. And then he suggests that this is what happened in a lot of Jesus' ministry as well. Jesus is walking around. He's on his way to do X, but he runs into, you know, the woman who's bleeding or whatever, and something else happens. And that those kinds of interactions happened at crossroads, and by golly, you better have a place in your city where people can run into each other, or you're going to lose that kind of accidental contact. Now, where are people going to run into each other? They're going to run into each other at the center. What's the center? Centers are a focal place for community activities where people are going to go to do one thing, then maybe they end up doing something else, or not, but at least they're down there. And so, you know, this is an aerial map of a neighborhood. Here's just the physical center. Let's not talk about what's there yet. It just happens to be physically in the middle of this particular map. Surrounded mostly by houses, but you can see there's some larger buildings a little bit in the center here. And not surprisingly, it's a place where a lot of people want to go. It's this, you know, sort of, fortunately, increasingly common bakery, wine, grocery, kind of the new convenience store, right? And it becomes a neighborhood center, and it's where you go to, you want milk, but you end up running into this, you know, neighbor that you need to see. In addition to sort of compact, you know, a focal place center that's in the middle, we also talk about centers and edges distributed along a street. We lived in a neighborhood until very recently that looked, I mean, I thought this was my neighborhood when I first saw this picture. There's a school right in the middle of the neighborhood right here. I don't know why they felt the need to blow this up, but anyway, it looks like a school from an old style school from the air. And then along this street were little shops, and you know there wasn't like a corner with shops. There was a street with shops, and you know, I guess it's hair splitting to call it whether it's a center or an edge. But in any case, This functioned as a kind of commercial center, but it also functioned as an edge to these neighborhoods. If you lived on this side, that was one neighborhood. If you lived on the other side, that was another neighborhood. You knew where you were from. And then this road functioned as the commercial center for both neighborhoods, but it also functioned as an edge. And you knew it was a legible kind of neighborhood. You knew where you were. Let's go down to the school to vote, or let's go to the meeting at the school, or let's go to the playground. And you knew where to go to get to those things, and standing anywhere in the neighborhood, because this was taller than everything else, you could see where you were. It was legible. It was understandable. And made people, I think it's fair to say, people felt comfortable in that situation because they knew where they were. Slight digression here. Who went to the U2 talk last night? Anybody? I'm a huge U2 fan, and but Chris said something last night that had never occurred to me, and I had heard a completely different interpretation of it, actually. He played the song Where the Streets Have No Name, and I had always interpreted that as being, in part, about a refugee camp where he had worked one summer, and as I understand it, it is, in fact, partially about that. There were no names to the streets in this refugee camp, but he also said, Chris said, Bono had explained at some point, in the neighborhood that he grew up in, you could tell everyone's social class by where they live, by their street name and their address. Mm-hmm. And so his one vision of, you know, the New Kingdom is a place where the streets have no name, so you don't know people rich, poor, you don't know. I thought that was just fascinating, and I think that there is something to that, and if you're in this neighborhood, that's one thing, and if you're in that neighborhood, that's another thing. Something to think about. It's not all good that the city is easily legible. You know, sometimes it's too legible, right? So, you know, some tensions to think about. Anyway, so center, edge, they work together to define neighborhoods and places. A community has connectivity. This is 1 mile square slices of four different parts of Philadelphia. And which do you think is better connected? Which 1 mile square is better connected to itself? If you live here, I don't want to cast too many aspersions, but speaking purely from a physical sort of infrastructure perspective, you're not very well connected to other parts of your neighborhood. A different way of looking at that is that connectivity then is crucial to relationship. And this is another way of looking at it. Here's the sort of standard suburban cul-de-sac street grid. And a kid that lives on this cul-de-sac, you know, probably most days he comes down here, you know, I don't know where he catches the bus, or probably his parents drive him at this point. But everybody, you know, comes out and goes out here and gets on the highway. He may know, you know, the kid in his class may live in the next cul-de-sac over. 99% of the time, this kid cannot go visit that kid across the cul-de-sac. There's a big fence, there's something else going on here, but there's no connectivity. And so the parent has to drive the kid all the way out here, back in here, et cetera. You know, and if everyone's doing that, this isn't central to my argument, but you know, what's the traffic on this link? It's huge, right? Because everybody has to go through there. And as the traffic on this link gets worse, the willingness of mom to go out here and sit at the stoplight goes down. Eventually the kid is sort of a prisoner in this cul-de-sac, even though they moved there for the kid. Over here, you know, everybody is connected, and I'm only talking about physically connected. I'm not talking about emotionally or commercially or any other kind of connection. But if you want to have the next kind of connection, if you live here and your friend lives arguably physically much further away over here than these two, it's much easier for kid A to go visit kid B. He can walk or he can ride. And if, for, you know, too small or whatever to walk or ride, there's any number of ways that mom can get from A to B, and so she's willing to drive him. Because, you know, if she knows that this stoplight is always jammed up, she just hates that. So she goes up here and goes around. There's choice, and that facilitates the relationship.
Or she trusts that the kid can bike there because the traffic on any one of those streets is not so heavy as the major artery.
Exactly. Now, Johnny, I know it's shorter to go this way, but I want you to stay on the street. So there's choice, and choice in this context, in this context, facilitates relationships.
Can I just throw in another? Maybe you're getting into this too, but there's also, I mean, the legibility of the two areas is really different. There was an article in we're from the Twin Cities, and there's an article in our paper a month or two ago about Eden Prairie, which is this, you know, western suburb, and how people who have lived there for years still get lost because it doesn't have, I mean, it just sort of grew in the way a lot of, you know, suburbs do in a sort of unplanned manner. And so there's, you know, the streets don't have a grid. There's not a simple kind of left-right way to orient yourself necessarily as you're going around. And so they had even the mayor, even Prairie, admitting that he at times, you know, can't lose his track where he is. He's disoriented because it's not as legible the way that community is.
Okay. And then the final point that I'd like to make about connectivity is that in one system you kind of have to have a car because things end up being a long way. This is the same point I was sort of just making but extending a little bit. The distance between these two things is really not that great, but the only way to get between them is with a car. Therefore, you must have a car. And if you don't have a car, you are excluded from the relationships in that community because you cannot get out and take part in them. Whereas if you don't have a car over here, it's fine because there's any number of other ways to get around. And the people like to say, well, everyone has cars anyway, so that's not being such a big deal. But in fact, most people do not have cars, arguably. The children don't have the cars. Old people that cannot drive anymore don't have cars. If you can't afford a car, you don't have a car. All of those parts of our communities are numbers that are increasing. The elderly substantially increasing in number. Increasing numbers of kids, you know, always. And unfortunately, the distribution of income changes, increasingly people find it difficult to afford cars. Yes?
Even with the car, there may not be a parking spot at the park.
Good point. Yeah. Exactly. Yes?
I think about where I live, a lot of the people who are on lower incomes are having to move out of the city, where it's easier, more accessible, things are more accessible. And so that's a challenge.
That is a challenge, yeah. Absolutely. That is a real problem. The statistics on what people end up spending their money on are really astonishing to me, actually. People now spend, on average, in most large cities, more of their income on transportation than on housing. Which is, you know, the first time that's ever happened. We could spend the rest of the hour talking about that one statistic. You know, why is that? Some of it's out of need. They move out for the cheaper housing, but then they have to buy four cars because everyone in the household has to have a car, and that ends up actually costing more than buying, you know, to begin with. You know, some of it, I would argue, is, you know, people want to have four cars anyway. For social reasons, not for need reasons, and to afford the four cars, then they have to move out. And, you know, that's a whole long discussion. But yes.
Help me with this, because I could be wrong, but I remember talking with someone who had been from New York City. She was 50 years old and had never had a car because they had no need for that kind of transportation. Then I talked with someone else who said, in a large town where there's the, I don't know what to call it, I'll call them an apartment building because they don't know the proper name.
Sure, yeah.
But their community and their children were just within that block. Mm-hmm. And so their connectivity was limited to, even though the grids were there,
right.
But their world, their community mm-hmm. was a block, and I was told that if you lived the next block over, you never met that
mm-hmm.
person.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's difficult for, I mean, because I'm not from that kind
yeah,
of a,
yeah.
But how do you fit those thoughts into what you're saying?
I had a good friend I was talking about just at breakfast, actually, who grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in one of these big apartment buildings. And he loved to say, you know, he was, in fact, his parents did not have driver's licenses, remarkably enough. They were, you know, quite successful professionals. And then I grew up in central Illinois, and, you know, everyone had a car to do anything. And it was kind of shocking to me to learn that there was this kind of family that didn't have cars. I think in his experience, we have time for so many relationships. Not that there's ever a total upper bound, but you know, you have time for so many people in your life. And if you, you know 400 people in your building, that may be all the people that you know, plus at work and school, that may be it that you have time for, or need, or want. And so the city offers the opportunity for broader relationships. That doesn't mean you will have them necessarily. It doesn't mean you have to have them necessarily. I would talk about that situation as, I mean, I don't know if your friend was happy with the fact that they only knew people in their building, right? I guess that would be the question. Did they feel limited by that circumstance, or did they feel like, hey, this is a small town right in my building, and it's kind of cool? I just don't know.
And in that respect, and I can almost see the cul-de-sac as in that same environment, mm-hmm. as a parent raising young children, my apartment block was, although I didn't live in a cul-de-sac, but mm-hmm. basically that same, the children, their relationships were with those that were close by, and yeah, they could meet someone else that lived in another community. But I mean, you could go on and on. I mean, I'd like to meet someone that
sure.
lived on the other side of the
sure.
the globe. You
yes.
know, so help me understand all of that.
Well, I guess it comes down to what facilitates the choice, in which I urge you to think about this for yourself. Which arrangement do you think offers more choice? And not that everyone wants the choice necessarily,
okay.
right? But a lot of people would like the choice, and
okay.
you know, my argument is that the one arrangement facilitates more choices than the other.
Thank
yes.
you. That answers my question.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you think there's kind of a critical mass point in terms of the number of people in a city. I'm from New York City, and it's just very rare. The forced contact is much, it outweighs the normal kind of contact. It's very rare for people to strike up a conversation with somebody on the subway or in the streets. If you run into somebody you know, okay, but
right.
strangers, they avoid each other.
Yeah. That's a good question. You know, I think that comes a little bit to community character. I would pose it in part in terms of numbers, when you pose your question. And in part in terms of character, arguably, there aren't very, very many places like New York, so it's a little bit difficult to say, you know, this other city like New York has a different dynamic to it. But I think, I would argue that it's harder to even strike up a conversation in Boston than it is in New York. It's probably easier in San Francisco. It's probably easier still in Seattle. I'm not sure that that's a function of, I mean, they're all big cities. Seattle's a lot smaller than New York, but I don't know, Mary, what you think. Would you say that there's a different spirit? It's not a function of the numbers, it's a function of
people.
Nancy, do you want
to? Yeah, I want to, in Seattle lately, there's been a lot of discussion in the newspapers about transplants complaining about that it's not as friendly a city, really,
uh-huh.
as New York.
Uh-huh.
You know, in New York, you know all your neighbors, you talk to them, but in Seattle, everybody's friendly on the surface. You know, you walk down the street, people talk to you, they give you directions, yada, yada. But now the people who have lived there a couple of years, coming from other places, say, well, it really isn't friendly. You never really get to know them. Either they don't invite you up to their house for dinner or in their backyard for a barbecue. And when I lived in New York or Philadelphia or LA or something like that, it was really friendly. So.
Yeah.
It's an interesting observation of people literally moving from other urban scenarios into Seattle.
Yeah,
I think they're wrong, actually, but I'm biased. But that's their experience.
Yeah.
I'm not saying their experience is their experience.
And communities have really different characters in terms of transients and stuff, too. I mean, Minneapolis-St. Paul always gets that same... People have that same complaint.
Yeah.
And that's partly because there are, I mean, Minneapolis has a very high rate of people who grow up there and stay there, or, you know, go away for a few years and then come back. And so you have generations, you know, who've never lived anywhere but Minnesota. And so, you know, there's just a very, and that makes it hard for people who come in without those familial connections to have that kind of deeper connectivity.
Yeah,
right. But people have a very positive experience of, you know, well, everybody is nice. the surface level is very different from like the East Coast, where, you know, you might have to get past a certain amount of brusqueness. But so it's very.
I think the question, though, in this context here, for me, is about just our whole American urban experience and what our expectation of that is. And if the vast majority of our population is urban, which it is not?
Right.
Do you know the percentage? I don't know. But anyway, but there's an expectation that City A will be like City B.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that if you move from one urban environment to another urban environment, you'll have the same thing, where there's not an understanding of maybe, well, wait a minute, maybe City B is actually a different place.
Right.
Yeah.
Other than the way it looks.
Yeah, right.
Franchising.
Yes.
I'm just wondering to what degree the changes in the evolution of our transportation systems have created more choices for people. I mean, I live in Seattle and I attend an urban church, and it's just occurring to me, thinking about this, trying to understand how our church has changed in its 100-year history from serving a geographic community to now no one lives in that geographic community, or a very small number of people. And all the churches in Seattle, everybody drives to from all over the place.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because we all have wonderful access to each other. It's a very dense, well laid out place. But we don't hang out with our neighbors. We drive all the way across town to hang out with people from the other end of town because we share, you know, it's an elective way of creating community that's not about geography.
Yes.
Yeah, we drive by six Lutheran churches.
Yes. That's exactly right.
So to what degree has the car really created a bunch of changes that have affected the way society interacts in urban settings, and is it good or bad?
Well, you've just hit the nail on the head, and you want to add to that?
I live in Spokane. I think the same thing happened in Seattle when the freeways went through. They decimated the inner city neighborhoods. And in Spokane, there are several really active core churches, but you're exactly right. They're not serving people in their neighborhood, because their neighborhood doesn't exist anymore, or it's been split. You can't get from here to there anymore.
I'm going to abstract that question just a little bit, if I may. I mean, I think you absolutely described the phenomenon, and I would have a couple of reactions. The first is, I would actually argue that people think that they have more, you described as having more choice in transportation. I would argue we actually have a little bit less now. You kind of have to drive, unless you're lucky enough to live in a particular place. But your broader point actually remains, and it raises the question of the forced community versus the chosen community, which I think is a very difficult question. And another author whose book I don't have, so I can't waive it, but was describing the difference between Jewish and Catholic reactions to this phenomenon, and the Jewish reaction almost everywhere was that you could leave the Jewish part of town and either go to another synagogue and they would welcome you there, or you could drive back and forth. And either one was okay. And, you know, we were the Jewish community, we were Jews, and so we will always welcome a fellow Jew, even if he moved from another part of town, etc. The Catholic response, until relatively recently, this isn't so true anymore, but the Catholic response is, you're a member of this parish. If you leave, you're no longer a member of this parish. This parish is a geographic unit, right? And if your roots are in this parish and you leave, you are leaving everything, right? And so what did Catholics do? They didn't leave for the, you know, until much more recently. And, you know, I think that's a fascinating, you know, you can argue about which is the more, put any adjective on it that you want, you know. welcoming, any number of adjectives. Which reaction should the worshiping community, whether you're Jewish or Catholic or Lutheran or whatever, have to the decision to move someplace else? And, hey, I want to join your community. Too bad. You know, you're a member of another community. Go back where you belong. That's kind of our thing. But if they don't do that, then what happens? Then everything blows up, and you have this absurd situation where you're driving past six other churches to go to your church. And what does that mean? You know.
It's good and bad. I serve a congregation that went from probably 50 years ago being largely a neighborhood church to very much a niche congregation now, because it's been reconciling for 20 years, and it is known for commitments to certain justice issues and things like that. And so there's lots of members who drive past any number of Lutheran churches, which is very easy to do in the Twin Cities, to come to ours. And, you know, not because they live in the neighborhood, but because they find the community there that they need, and, you know, that they're not going to find necessarily in their neighborhood. So there's, you know, there's two sides of the same coin.
The trend in new apartment buildings and condominiums is interesting, because in Tacoma, for example, and in Spokane, they are building large units downtown areas, mm-hmm. and living in the principal way that you show in New York City. Mm-hmm. And this is growing with a lot of, and the idea is we don't need a car.
Right. I think people really miss that. And the way I'll try, and I want to hit a couple more points. This is a fantastic conversation, I need to cut it off, but if I may sort of wrap it up from my perspective, I think that those new kinds of communities are incredibly popular, and people will pay. This is another problem we have in my line of work, is you want to have a community, and this is the next point I'm going to make, where everybody can live. You can have a cross-section of economic strata. But people want these communities so much, they're willing to pay so much money for them, that they very quickly become just the refuge of the province of the rich. And it's a real problem. But to me, the answer is, the economist pops up and says, well, build more, just meet the demand, until you've met the demand. But the way I would like to wrap this little discussion section up is, I think up until recently, the problem with some of the forced geographic communities were that you didn't have, you can fill in all the problems that are obvious. And some of the new communities offer the choice to develop that community. They don't force it. If you really don't, like whatever, your neighbors, they have whatever large or small problem, you don't have to belong to that community, but you can. And this allows for and facilitates and supports the community, and this does not. I'm not going to say never, it's very difficult to do that here, and it's much easier to do it here. And I think if that's what we want, if we think that that's good for people, then we should be building more of this and a lot less of this. So that would be my wrap on that. I don't have a lot to say on this other than to refer you sort of to history, in which people could, in the phrase that's a little bit unfortunate, but it's also descriptive, age in place. And I don't mean age like you hit 50 and then you age in place, but I mean, from 5 months through, you could spend your whole life in the community because there was a mix of housing and ways to get around in that community. And so, any number of people will tell you, older people now, they were born in this house, then they moved to this house, and then, they got out of college, or maybe they didn't go to college, but they worked, in whatever, and they had this apartment, and then they moved, a couple of blocks over and bought their first starter house, and then they got a bigger house, with the kids, but it was all in the community. And then when they were empty nesters, they moved to a smaller one, and then eventually they were back in an apartment. But they could still, even though they couldn't drive anymore, walk to the corner store, to the coffee shop to see their friends, etc. And you had your whole life in that community, because there were places, there were housing options that supported all of those different steps in your life. And we don't do that anymore either. If you, want an X-sized house, now you have to move to this city because they have zoned for those houses in that city. And that's really all those people want, because they want the tax base from the expensive houses or whatever, and so they've zoned only for large lot, you know, expensive houses. And if you, you know, are just out of college and don't have very much money, then you have to live in uptown. And, you know, once you start a family, very few families stay in uptown because, you know, any number of reasons, but one of the reasons is there are not good homes for people like that. And I'm talking about in Minneapolis, in uptown, they have to move out, they feel like they have to move out to the suburbs. And a community, I would argue, does not force that moving around, so you have to uproot your whole family and make new, you know, make a new social support structure every time you change life circumstance. You know, arguably one of the reasons that now people drive all over to go to X church is that they can still drive to that church, even though they've had to move communities within the larger urban area, they can still stay at that church, and now that's become sort of a grounding in a way that the physical community used to. But that's an aim that I think a good city should aim for, is that it supports people throughout their lives. Now, closely related to that, but a little bit distinct, if you can live here, you can work here. And that, again, used to be the case, and it's increasingly not the case, and I can't make this thing go backwards as far as I can tell. I don't want to distract you with all these questions before we talk about that for a minute. But, you know, the police and the school teachers and, you know, for that matter, folks that work in the hospitality or, you know, do house cleaning or whatever, any number of people that we would like to be part of our community, in an increasing number of communities, cannot work there. They are not part of the community. You will never now run into your teacher in the grocery store. Do you remember running into your teacher at the grocery store? And you're like, that's the weirdest thing. She needs groceries? She's real.
I'm kind of curious, when you say that, well, how many people here, I'm just curious, how many people here grew up in a community that was connected? And, I mean, and was it in a city environment, or was it in a country environment, or
both?
Both.
City.
Small.
Rural.
Small city.
Country.
Yeah, Midwest type country. Yeah.
Right.
And then I moved out to an area that, oh my. This is interesting to me personally. Very much.
So I there's a lot to say about that, but it also, you know, I think you can suggest the idea that captures most of what one wants to say.
It's that last question, it's not even just for, you know, the house workers. I'm clergy and I can't live in the community that I'm called to serve.
Exactly.
Because the houses cost too much.
Right. Exactly. Okay, well, we've only got 5 minutes left. I've got, like, you know, days more material in the computer. But maybe if you want to think about as we go forward, is Holden, this is to me a bit of a stretch, but I just suggest it as an idea. Think about, does Holden exemplify any of these goals for a community? And if so, how? And then, you know, how about where you live and what are your choices about living or not living in a connected community? I was hoping we'd have time to talk about that. Maybe we can come back and talk about that, but I want to make a couple more points just because I can't resist. The first is there's been a tremendous amount of debate in my little subfield about, in the internet age, you know, what's the role of the city, right? And the questions here are, and we talk about internet communities, right? You know, what is that kind of community relative to the community I've been talking about? And then what does real contact mean in the context of the internet? And what I will suggest to you, and again, we can talk about it, or you can talk about it at lunch or whatever, is, you know, the city has not gone away. And argue, you know, some people argue, well, it hasn't had time to go away yet. Other people argue it has gone away. You know, the suburb has won, and that's not a city. And so the answer is that my question is wrong. The city is not surviving. I would argue the city is surviving, and, you know, all those people that moved back to Manhattan after 9/11, why? Because that's where the contact is, and they can't have their life and do their work without that kind of contact. You know, in the financial world, just to take one of many possible examples, I mean, if anything, you know, the reign of the computer and the automated program and the trading programs and the ability to do anything from anywhere in the financial world, you know, should mean the Wall Street goes away, or the downtown Chicago and the grain market goes away. You can do it all by computer. They do not, because there are aspects of that profession that require you to go to lunch with somebody. They just do. And one of the jokes in my in the consulting world is, you know, if you hate to fly, do not start up a conversation with somebody that you, by internet, by email, that you don't want to eventually fly to go see. Because if you have an internet conversation with them, over time, you will go fly and see them. Because there are aspects of sitting down with somebody across the table that you that the internet cannot fix. And, you know, flying to see somebody can support a certain amount of that relationship, but, you know, it fails over time. And if you really want to be a part of that professional, artistic, you know, whatever community, you got to be there. You got to be in that town. You got to go to the opening. You got to, you know, go to lunch with people. You got, and that's why the city is going to survive, because we remain human. So that's my argument. That doesn't mean the city doesn't face a lot of threats from the internet and everything else. But I think that the need for it anyway is absolutely going to remain. I think that I have one more. Hyatt's. The title, if you came for the title was, you know, trends, colon, relationships, human, natural, and sacred. I haven't talked anything about the non-human environment. Really the only thing I'm going to say about that is that living in a compact city frees up the rest of the planet to not be paved over, and preserves wilderness by concentrating our activity in a smaller area. And so it remains, you know, we can argue about whether we're going to better encounter God in the stranger downtown in a dense environment, or whether we're going to encounter God better out here. I think they absolutely fit together. We're going to encounter God both places. Best that both places be what they are, and we keep the wilderness, we make the city a real city, and that this attempt to sort of move out to the fringe and have it both ways, you know, is just, you're going to get neither one. Because it's not the wilderness and it's not a city, and you're not going to encounter anybody there, frankly, is my completely unvarnished take on the situation. So that's all I'm going to say about the natural and sacred relationships that I promised in my title. I think that that wraps us up, and I've been talking for the whole hour instead of just the half of it that I really intended to, but I had a lot to say, so. We can, I don't know if there's anything after this, we can hang out.